You're at your old trusty boat. You call Mighty Sparrow. I'm in the city of Mardi Gras.
Welcome to the Sailing Into Oblivion podcast, where we sit down with everyday people who do extraordinary things. I'm your host, Jerome Rand.
Good afternoon, everybody. Coming to you live from North Sound, Virgin Gorda in the BVI. We are halfway through the two-weeker down here as the Adventurer in Residence. Again, one of the coolest titles I've ever had, and it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been super fun meeting, greeting, and telling sea stories, whether it's above the quarterdeck at the pub up there or out on the beach around a bonfire. I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it has been a lot of fun. I am truly humbled that I would ever be invited to do something like this, and it's really been quite an experience, you know. And I honestly, one of the things I thought about the other day is I was like, wow, you know, a lot of these people are, they're all on vacation, essentially, and you know, you have to make sure you're utilizing every minute when you're on a vacation, and you don't want to waste any time. And the fact that people will slice away an hour or so and come and listen to me is it's quite nice and makes an adventurer feel good. I'll tell you that much. And we did a little full moon sailing last night. We got another round coming up tonight. Ah, it's fun in the sun. And if you haven't been to the BVI, make it a destination for at least once in your life, because it is absolutely amazing down here. That being said, today's podcast is actually pretty interesting. Speaking of, you know, meeting people and making connections and stuff, one of the things I've been doing is these clinics. And one of the very first ones last week, a gentleman walks up and he's like, hey, you know, I'm wanting to take my Fleming 68, which is a powerboat, across the Atlantic, and wanted to talk to you about open ocean action. And I, you know, I was like, holy cow, okay, this will be great. We broke it all down. We talked provisioning. We talked everything. The gentleman's name is Julian McQueen. And, you know, after listening to him and chatting with him for about an hour, I was like, hey, you know, you're an adventurous type. I'd love to sit down for the podcast. And he's like, yeah, you know, I actually, you know, I talked to him about going around the world and some of the other trips that I was presenting while I was here. And he said, oh, well, I went around the world on a Honda jet. Interest spiked at that moment. And we got along well enough that he invited me aboard his beautiful vessel. And we had a nice conversation about airplanes and the similarities between flying your own jet and sailing on the ocean blue. And Julian's got some great stories. And I'm going to include in the episode description a link to the YouTube video. It's about 20 minutes long that goes through. He and his lovely wife, Kim, have basically just shows you everything and everywhere they go. I think they Honda Jet did like a little documentary on them. So well worth the watch. And yeah. Oh, man. There's some sort of listening device that just turned on and was listening to me. But in any event, yeah, so this podcast was pretty cool. And Julian definitely tells some pretty epic stories. And yeah, it was really, really fun. So hopefully you will enjoy this one. And before we start, like I always say, if you want to help support this show, like so many of you have, we've got some new members to the Patreon family. Super, super appreciative. We are about to turn over a $4,200 deposit to North Sails. And so I'm a little worried, but I got to do it. We got to get those sails so we can get back on the ocean. So every little bit helps. We've got the links for Venmo, PayPal. It's crunch time, you know. It's sort of, I got to put my money where my mouth is and get back out there. So the help is much appreciative. And you know who you are, the people that have been supporting this. So the efforts are not lost on me. We've also got the merch line. We got the books. We got everything. All links in the description. Follow those to help support everything. And if you just want to reach out to the show, sailingintooblivion.com, podcast button, click on the link, contact the show. Those go directly to me. I'm down in the BVI for another week, and then it's Florida for a week, another gig up there, and then back home to Michigan. So woo, it'll be just under a month on the road for me, so to speak. This is my first international speaking tour. Wow, I can't even believe I get to say that. So enjoy the show. This is my conversation with Julian McQueen. Well, Julian, thanks for sitting down, and thank you for having me aboard this beautiful vessel. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming out here instead of doing it on the land.
Yeah. Oh, my pleasure. I mean, just for the audience, we're sitting in one of the most beautiful places in the world, I think, the middle of the North Sound on Virgin Gorda. And do you want to tell us just a little bit about the boat we're on?
I would love to. Yeah, the boat is a Fleming 65. It's something we started designing 2 years ago in Taiwan, and basically went to the guys that were selling the boat and said, what would you do if you created the perfect boat, all the bells and whistles, everything that you had ever wanted? And and they loaded me up with all kinds of stuff, and then I just started taking away
instead of
trying to figure out how to add to.
Yeah,
that worked out pretty good. I didn't take a lot of things away and came up with a boat that's got pretty much everything after being on it for almost a year. It has pretty much everything on it that I can imagine. I can't think of anything more.
And it was built in Taiwan.
Yeah.
And what was the transport process?
So yeah, they put it on a cargo ship and sent it to Baltimore. And the dealer for Fleming is in Annapolis. And so, you know, they picked it up in Baltimore and went the, you know, 2 hour trek to down to Edgewater, actually, Maryland. And that's where they do all the electronics, all the pieces and parts that are in the boat that are outside of the normal.
Kind of all the custom features that you're looking at.
And I like buttons. I like technology. And
I like so gadgets.
I put a whole bunch of gadgets on there, and they spent 4 months doing that process.
Oh, wow. Holy smoke. So start to finish from concept to you actually hopping on board, firing up the engine. How long was that?
So we ordered it in August, and it came and was delivered in June, almost 2 years later.
2 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. A lot of anticipation, I would assume that.
And I'm learning in the process, right? I'm trying to figure out what it is I've actually got myself into. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Probably a lot of research. I mean, that's one of the interesting things. You know, Mighty Sparrow is such a basic boat. I mean, and I've done that on purpose after reading the accounts of all the guys that did it back in the day when essentially navigation was a chart and a sextant, and the only electronics they might have had on the boat would be a Marconi radio and possibly a couple of lights, and that was it.
Wow.
But the beauty of that is, you know, there's not a whole lot that can go wrong at that point, you know, outside of obviously the rigging and the mast and the sails and all that. But the other thing is that you don't have to rely on things that can go wrong. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that your boat doesn't have, you know, I'm sure pretty much these systems look pretty bulletproof, and they're trying to even think how I can describe it. It looks like I feel like standing at that helm, I'm in like Star Trek or something.
Well, one thing I loved about the Fleming guys is that they were aeronautical engineers first.
Oh, really?
That kind of connection with my aviation background was a nice connection. So the logic and everything that goes around how they lay things out, I could relate to.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, and I think, going from aviation, which is very heavily reliant on huge amounts of technology, to then go onto a boat. Because on a boat, you can get away without it. And I suppose, have you ever flown like a biplane or some one of those old ones?
I've flown and started flying when I was 16. So,
oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, I got my license then. And back then, it was 4 gauges, and that's all you had.
That's it.
Yeah, so everything was seat of the pants. So I'm very old school when it comes to flying.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, love the technology and
of all the newer stuff.
And kind of pride myself in keeping up with it. So it's two different worlds. But when things go poorly, you always go back to your basics, right? And you fly the airplane and you use the seat of the pants. And if everything feels right there, you know you're going to be okay.
Well, and we had spoke a little bit as we came over, and we'll get into like all the trips and stuff, but it's crazy the similarities and the differences between, and just a backstory, you took a small jet around the entire planet. I took a slow boat all the way around the planet.
Right.
There's a lot of things that are similar, but there's a lot of things that are very different. And one of the things I think that's different is the amount of time you have to deal with things going poorly, as you say.
Yes, 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 yes.
I mean, a boat sinking usually takes a good while.
Right.
A plane falling, on the other hand, right, is very, very different.
Yeah, 400 knots versus four.
Four, yeah. Five on a good day.
Five on a good day. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking, for sure.
Well, I guess, can I just ask you, have you ever crashed a plane before?
I am going, the long pause is to tell you that I've not ever crashed a plane, but I did some really dumb things, like every pilot.
I've been
flying for 55 years, and you know, most of that time, a lot of that time, not most now, but a lot of that time was visual flight rules, VFR.
Okay. And, so that for a sailboat, that'd be just line of sight navigation, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good comparison. And I did that way too long. I did that for 20 years before I got my instrument rating. And you get into situations. My poor wife has, you know, been through thick and thin.
How fat.
But it's a
shout out to Kim.
There's some incidences that I had up in the Yukon that flying a 75-year-old flying boat and you know, got into some ice and bad weather and tried to figure out how to get through it to get back to Mother Earth, and it was dicey.
Yeah.
But the first one, frankly, was when I was 16, and there's a reason you don't give 16-year-olds pilot license, and I approved it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to go into it, but if you would, that'd be pretty interesting.
You know, I don't know.
Maybe the abbreviated version.
The abbreviated version is this. I was a student pilot. I thought that was a lame rule that I could not take my friends flying. But I was a student pilot, and you're never supposed to take your friends flying. And I've never recorded this on a public forum.
You don't have to.
But you know, I'm so old now, I don't really care. And so this is what happened. I said to my buddies, go down to this country road, and then look around, make sure it's okay to land. I'll just land on the road. What's the difference between a road and a runway?
No way.
And so they went down to this, this is in Destin, Florida, and they went down to this road called 30A, which is...
The statute of limitations is definitely out on this.
Oh, so. Yeah. But my ego, anyway, it was humbling. And I think about it every time I fly now, and I've been flying for a long time. So they went to the road, and... And I came in on top of them, and I had 9 hours. That's all the time I had in the airplane, or flying, period. I'd just gotten my solo license. And so they lined up on the road, and then the first thing I noticed was that roads are not as wide as runways.
Yeah.
And then also, runways don't have 30-foot pine trees on either side. And they don't have power lines, and they don't have hills, and they don't have a lot of things. And so I said, y'all find a nice flat surface, straight, and I'll find you, and I'll land right over your heads, and then we'll get in the airplane, do some rides, and I'll go back to the airport. Well, as I'm coming up, I'm circling around trying to build my courage, and I realize I'm really over my skis at this point. I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
So I line up a very long final approach, and I'm coming right over their heads about 20 feet, and they're waving me in like, you're doing great. And about the time I get... almost on top of them, they look up at me, and I look down at them over the yoke of the airplane, and they're waving their hands like this, like,
go back up.
And I look up, and it turns out they're standing underneath a power line. And I hit the power line.
Oh, wow.
With the prop, but I happened to hit it with the spinner, so it perfectly sliced the power line, and the trailing edges of the power line hit the wing, and the wing pulled it, you know, it pulled the airplane over into the pine trees.
Oh my
god. And at the very last second, I pulled out.
Yeah.
And went back to the airport and did what every 16-year-old does. I landed the airplane and I ran. Thinking, "Oh, they'll never figure out that it was me that damaged this airplane." And I didn't really look around at the damage much. I was just happy to be on the ground.
Yeah, right.
And a week later, the guy that owns airports sees me in the grocery store with my mom and says, "We have to talk." And I go over and talk to him, and he knows I don't have any money. He said, "Look, you damaged the airplane, and I know you don't have any money, so I just want you to remember this this flight for the rest of your life. Every time you get into an airplane, remember this flight.
Yeah.
Because it's not guaranteed that things are going to work out well.
Wow.
And you were very lucky. Turns out I knocked out the power for miles around.
So,
there was no secret that there was some low-flying airplane near the airport.
Yeah.
Down a country road.
Anyway. But he sounds like he protected you a little bit. He probably could have been like, all right, I know who did it, and turned you in.
Yeah, he could have been. He had every right to just fillet me right there. But, he chose the high road, and I'm really happy he did.
And it doesn't sound like you forgot that flight.
No.
Do you still think about it every time you get in a plane?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the same time, I have this kind of idea that I'm living on borrowed time, right? Cause it,
Sixteen years
old, you run into a power line and an airplane. I mean, people don't walk away from stuff like that.
No, they don't.
But I just happened to hit it just right, and it exploded the power line. So the trailing edges didn't have any strength to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So when they hit the wings, you know, it didn't have any. It just hit it like a big bird.
Sort of glanced. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Julian! I can't even believe you're still here. Like, and people say that exact thing to me all the time too, especially after they see the presentation I'm going to do tonight.
Yeah,
like,
I'm in awe of what you did.
Oh man. Well, the wait till you see the one tonight. It all went so poorly so quickly, and a lot of it was my fault for going, but. You know, we like you said, just with that story right there, we do, you know, we make our choices, you commit to it, and you hopefully learn.
All right.
To get, you know.
Yeah, the learning is the important piece of that.
Yeah, the takeaways are always pretty darn good. Well, so going from that and the smaller planes and all that sort of stuff, the real meat of what we wanted to talk about today is going around the world on the Honda Jet. So first off, I guess, can you explain what the Honda Jet is? Because I, watching that YouTube video, instantly I was like, holy cow, that looks like a Lamborghini of small jet airplanes.
It's a great description. Yeah, it's a concept airplane that Mr. Fujino came up with out of a dream. He woke up and then sketched it down. He was looking for something to sketch on, and he sketched it on the back of a calendar.
Really?
Yeah, this idea of having the engines on top of the wings. It's over the wing engines. And no private jet has that. It's reserved for much larger commercial type operations. But most jets, as you know, have the engines attached to the fuselage.
Yeah.
And he came up with this idea that if you put it over the wings, it would separate the vibration and the noise. And then he sculpted the fuselage out of fiberglass,
mm-hmm.
and created this dynamic flow that was unique. So between the dynamic flow over the fuselage and the over the wing engines, he created more efficiency, you know, less vibration, much quieter cabin.
Yeah.
And it's a revolutionary airplane that took them almost 8 years to get to market. And so I reserved one early on, and thank God they didn't deliver it any sooner because I didn't have the money. So I was happy with their delays and took delivery. I didn't want to be the first, but I wanted to be after the first 100. So my serial number was 55.
Oh, okay.
And
to work the bugs out?
Yeah, I wanted somebody else to work the bugs out.
Yeah, right. You've had enough close calls.
So anyway, 2017, I took delivery in April, and then in July we took off to go around the world, and my wife and I, and to set a record of sorts, and it did set a record for the first Honda Jet to fly around the world.
Yeah.
Single pilot. I should mention that. It's a single pilot airplane.
Yeah, because it was you. I mean, there were times like flying into, oh, shoot, where was it, where you had to have a secondary pilot or a navigator with you?
Yeah, in Bhutan.
Bhutan, yeah. Paro,
Bhutan.
That sounded sketchy.
That was sketchy. It was very, very sketchy. And it's funny, they require you to have a special instruction to fly into Kathmandu.
Oh, really? Is that because of the altitude?
It's the altitude and the way the mountains are surrounding the airport that your go around, if things go wrong, your go around is very, very tight.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're sitting there essentially at the base of, you know, some of the largest mountains in the world, and so they train you for that on a separate class. You have to go to a separate training. But in this case, there is no training because there are no instrument approaches to this airport. And in order to fly into Bhutan, you have to have a Bhutanese first captain sitting in your right seat.
Yeah.
And it's all visual. It's all visual flight rules. So you come out of, you know, the airport's at 7,000 feet. You know, the mountains are at 27,000 feet, and you drop down into this valley. And at that point, you're on your own, just like flying a Cessna 150. I mean, jeez, all of a sudden you're on your own, but you're flying a commercial, not a commercial, but a small jet. And so the guy is telling me, go to this mountain. If you can see the mountain, you can see there's a monastery on the side of it. Go to that monastery and take a left. And I'm going, what? Okay. And then you go down this valley and you see another building. He says, okay, at that building, take a right, and then slow the airplane and start to land. And there was no airport. I couldn't see the airport.
Yeah.
He said, trust me, I know what I'm doing. I went, I've known you for 45 minutes.
Yeah, right.
My wife is in the back. And all the alarms are yelling, terrain, terrain.
Yeah, alert, you said alert. That. Right, right.
And I'd never heard it before, and I didn't even know how to turn it off. So I'm focusing on finding that airport.
Yeah,
and I slow the airplane down, put the flaps, the wheels, dirty it up. And he says, it's going to be there. Just trust me. And it's over the next hill. And sure enough, there it was. And the point being is you can't... If you come in too fast, you'll overfly. You won't be able to flare and land.
Yeah.
And the go around for that is really, really not something you want to. You don't want to do a go around in a Paro, Bhutan.
Well, because the mountains around limit. You know, I guess you'd have to go way, way up.
Right.
Yeah. Not easy. Yeah. Not easy.
You have to. Yeah. It's not really an option. So. You have to make it the first time.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, all these, when I was watching the video and just listening to you now, I'm thinking in my head how similar that is when you come into a marina and they have, you know, the fairway in between the finger piers or whatever is real narrow and you have one shot to get into that slip. And if something, you know, you come in at the wrong time or whatever and you blow it. And you have to try and do like a pivot turn in there and the wind's blowing and all that and sort of the nerve-wracking circumstances. I mean, it's because, I don't know, it's just boats dealing with water and the fact that it's not, you know, a car is, I don't know, it's like fixed on the earth and you can stop it and you can turn it and there isn't much else that's going to affect its motion. But a plane and a boat.
Yeah.
Wind and the sea and all that.
Yeah.
So you really have to have kind of that instinctual feel. And I guess like you were saying, you might rely quite a bit on the electronics, but when it comes down to it and things go poorly, you got to go right back to feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Seat of the pants, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I see a tremendous amount of parallels between, you know, being in a boat, a larger boat and in an airplane, because you have the current and you have the wind, you have the waves, you have the restrictions, you have the approach, you have your backup plan and things don't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love the idea that in an airplane and I think largely in a boat, you have to be thinking about your arrival
way ahead.
Yeah. Like when you start off. In an airplane, it's really critical that you plan the whole trip ahead before you take off, because you can't really pull over and think about it.
No, not one. There's like a certain point where you are committed to it and you have to keep moving forward. There's like, you know, there is a point where you can't just throw the boat in reverse and try and get out of there. Sometimes you have to keep going forward. And like I said, you know, I go out and do these consulting. I mean, it's instruction essentially. But that's typically the first thing we always start with is just docking a boat
yeah.
and close quarters maneuvering in a marina. But that is like my first rule is you're going to plan all these things out well before you get to that dock. Yeah. Because when I see people, when you see the normal show and the screaming starts and the dock yes. gets bounced off, that is a direct result of no prior planning. You know, the captain's just back there. He's just expecting to nail it. And everybody will tie the boat off, but he hasn't informed anybody about anything.
Right.
And then, you know, it doesn't go according to his plan. And so, yeah, it is. It's one of those things you really have to, you want to nail down every little thing and not only have your plan, but then have the contingency, the plan B and maybe even the plan C.
Yeah. And it, the coordination, I think, is something that is unique for boating versus you know, airplanes, because if you're a single pilot,
it's just you.
It's just you. And yeah. you make your own mistakes and you suffer the consequences. But in a boat, when you're docking, it's a crew.
It's a team effort.
You have to coordinate that. And people can't read your mind. As long as I've been married, my wife still can't read my mind. It's very frustrating.
I wish it would finally happen.
But it's just not. And so, you know, we have a plan, and also it's a little seductive because you're moving so slow, right?
Yeah, yeah. You think not much is gonna happen.
Yeah, but when things go wrong, and the momentum of us.
How much does she weigh?
This is 77 and a half tons.
Oh, at two knots, you can still do a lot of damage.
Yes, and I have done that. So,
hey, the first scratch, man, it's a gimme. It's a mulligan.
Yeah, so it's it's stopping that momentum is really interesting. You don't hold this boat off. That was one of my first lessons.
I don't think you should hold off any boat. I have personally witnessed people not break bones, but definitely smash fingers and hands on boats under 20 feet. And I always say, hey, we can fix the boat.
Right.
We can do that real easily, and it's going to be a better lesson for the old yahoos, who's trying to park it so abruptly. Yeah. So, you know, there's lessons to be learned in those little mishaps.
So another fun parallel is that, you know, at an airport, every pilot will stop what they're talking about when they see an airplane land.
Yeah, same on the dock.
Same thing on a boat.
The dock committee or the marina committee, whatever it is.
And I've often thought that everybody should like hold up scorecards like the Olympics and score your landing. And
had you been here at Bitter End before?
No.
Okay, so in 2009 we had Hurricane Earl, and that ripped out the old quarterdeck dock. Okay. And so the old quarterdeck dock came directly out from shore. Comes right out, one big thing, and then it teed a huge long pier with a bunch of fingers. So the fingers were coming out here. Now the wind wraps around Bitter End, and you get a big gust from this side, and then an 180-degree shift 30 seconds later from that side.
Got it.
And when the windy season, you know, January, February, March, it's blowing pretty hard. And the pub used to be right there. And so at 5 o'clock, when all the charter boats are trying to dock, and it was really difficult to dock here, that was the show.
Yeah.
Everybody went to the pub, and you watched because it was just chaos that ensued. And oh, man.
I understand that now.
And I would think, though, maybe that's the one thing that doesn't really add up. Because if you really blow it in an airplane landing, it's a little different than bumping off the dock.
Yeah. The consequences are pretty extraordinary. You know, it's difficult to recover from a bad mistake in a jet.
Yeah.
Everything's happening so quickly.
So quick.
And
if you mind me asking, what's the typical speed when you are actually making your final approach for
109.
109 knots. Yeah. Knots. Okay.
So it's happening quickly.
And yeah.
And, you know, there's something about the Honda jet that is unique is it has winglets. So you have these vertical tips of the wing.
Uh-huh.
And those act almost like sails. So if you have a crosswind, you get some pretty dramatic effects on your rollout.
And, uh-huh.
That's where actually there's been a lot of issues with the Honda jet because people don't realize that those winglets are catching wind, and it'll pick up your wing, and you'll come up on one side of it, and all your squat switches that are telling your steering that you're on the ground are now giving mixed messages to the to the computerized, gear brake system, so that the anti-lock system on the brakes are now confused because they, you've got one wheel that's up in the air and then the other wheels are on the ground. Anyway, it turns into a big ordeal real quickly.
That sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And there's been a lot of incidences with the Honda Jet that they're retraining everybody on, but I've never had a problem.
Then why would they have, what benefit do you have from these winglets?
So if you look at the big commercial jets, they all have winglets. It turns out it takes all that dynamic flow that flows down the wings, and it harnesses that and increases your lift and makes it more efficient. So all that dispersed flow is now being used by these winglets, and
I suppose it's revolutionary. Because the fuselage punching through the air is going to push air away from it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can see how that would work.
But the dynamic, the lift dynamics of a wing, everything is being pushed towards the end. And if you can harness that with these winglets, it was revolutionary when they came out. And now you see every single commercial jet has them.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Because it saves fuel and it makes you go faster.
Right.
It's a cleaner flow. Yeah,
that's so interesting.
It is.
we as a sailor, you're studying those sails, and it takes a long time and a lot of experience to really get good at the feel of the boat. Whether it's a race boat or if it's an old double ender like I have, I mean, one of the trickiest things for these older boats that don't go very fast is that you have to have kind of an intuition, because you have to get the boat up to a certain speed before it really starts to feel right. But there's a real change in everything that goes on. As you increase your forward speed, you're creating a headwind, which is changing the apparent wind angle and all sort of stuff. And it's kind of in slow motion on these older boats, the heavy displacement boats, compared to like a newer monohull. And it's funny because a lot of people who just sail newer boats hop on a boat like mine and they're like, this thing sails terrible, like this is awful, stupid slow boat. And it really is just they don't understand it and they don't have the patience to really feel out what's going on and how that wing is delivering that power to the boat and how the boat is picking up steam and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, it's crazy. It's I've always thought that bending wind around a foil is like truly becoming one with Mother Nature. It's like an art form. And yeah, I mean, it may be different at 250 or 400 knots slicing through the air, but it's essentially the same sort of theory and everything.
Yeah, it's the same theory, but to your point, there is a disconnect.
Yeah,
everything is so electronic.
Is that what the term fly by wire means?
Yeah. Everything, even the nose is being steered by a motor. The nose steering or the nose wheel is being steered by our motor. So that connection between your rudders on the your rudder pedals in the front wheel that you have going up through your experience ratings in airplanes is gone. You don't have that anymore. So it's now you're actually giving inputs into a servo that's telling another servo to do something with your front wheel. So there, that connectivity is a whole nother, a whole nother learning process to get a feel for. But every airplane has a feel, to your point. Every boat has a different feel. Every airplane has a different feel. And over time, with enough hours, you start to feel that. And one of my worries, actually, for the younger generation is that they don't necessarily have the time to have the basic instruments and the basic flying skills of feeling that connection.
It's all straight into the tech.
Yeah, every control surface is being delivered with a direct response to the pilot. these ones are, you know, the current ones and all the electronics that go with them really disconnect the pilot from the flying, the true flying experience.
It's almost like they really, it would behoove them to, you know, hop in an old crop duster for, you know, a year or whatever to just get the feel where there really isn't any instruments, right?
Crop duster would be. Would get the job done.
Yeah, I'll bet, right? Oh my gosh. Well, it's kind of funny you say that because one of the points that I made in the keynote speaking that I was doing last week was the difference, how technology has changed in the sailing world. So 25 years ago when I learned, I used a paper chart. We didn't trust GPS all that much. And we learned how to use a sextant and stuff. And now, if I want to cross an ocean, all I need is an iPhone, technically, to navigate that. And that's opened the floodgates to a lot of people who don't have the actual necessary experience to be on the ocean, but they can navigate using their iPhone. And those are the people that get into trouble, come back ashore, and then they call me. And then I hop on board with them and try and, like I said, steepen that learning curve so that they can get back out there and don't sell the boat.
It's very, very similar to airplanes. And today's pilots, so much is being driven by GPS.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have GPS for the first 35 years of flying.
Everything
was paper chart.
Everything.
And
so then you must know how to do sextant and all that stuff, right, from back then?
No sextant. But
so no night flying then?
You can night fly and you can navigate by land and night flying.
But okay.
Where cities are, you're looking at lights.
Yeah.
Where roads are, you're looking for taillights of cars.
Right.
Or headlights. I mean, you can pick out land features at night.
That's terrifying.
Through the light.
I couldn't even imagine that. Like, that's the worst nightmare when you're coming into a harbor or a port at night.
Right.
Is all the background lights.
Yeah,
sort of wash out the say 10 navigation red and greens that you're looking for.
Right.
And even those navigation ones, when they're all lined up, each light has a specific blink to it. So, you know, one will be one every 5 seconds. The next one will be quick flash. The next one will be so that you can differentiate.
Yeah.
But looking for tail lights, doing a 200 knots. It's all too fast, Julian. It's too fast.
Well, imagine.
Giving me anxiety over here.
Imagine what it was like in the 40s and the 30s.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the whole World War II experience is just fascinating to me to see how these guys could, you know, leave the continental U.S. and end up in Europe.
As
a regular routine, and they had to go find Iceland on the way because if they didn't find Iceland, then they were lost. They were just out in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere.
Just looking at their fuel gauge.
Looking at their fuel gauge and really not having fixes along the way to guide you.
Nothing.
So you're using a watch and you're using
dead reckoning,
what you think,
right?
Are the winds aloft, right? So the winds aloft can take a dead reckoning and blow it just like a tide or a current.
Or current, yeah. Except the jet stream's moving at 200 knots?
Yeah.
Oh my, I didn't even think of that.
So there's actually a wonderful book, and I wish I could remember the name of it, where it's talking about this transport pilot that's flying into Iceland.
Uh-huh.
And it's completely fogged out. I mean, they cannot, it's 0-0, and they don't know where the ground is, right?
Yeah.
Because your barometric pressure changes from one point to another.
Right.
And the way they find out is they literally drop a weight off of a string until it hits the water. And they're flying.
Oh my God.
And then they pull it back up and says, "Oh, we're 500 feet over the water. We better level out."
Really?
Yeah, and then leveling out, how do you do that if you don't have any
bearings
on the horizon?
Well, but that couldn't that be like a I guess you'd call it archaic or whatever, old like gyroscope kind of compass. You know how a compass can kind of give you that?
Yeah, a compass, but it precesses and based on your turn.
So
what a lot of these guys did was they put a weight on the end of a string inside
like
the cockpit.
Right. And a plum.
Yeah, a plum.
Yeah.
And they would see if they were straight and by the plum. That looks pretty close.
Oh my gosh. The only comparison I can make with that, when I was taking Sparrow up to Bellhaven, I had to go for 20, 30 miles on the intracoastal. And Sparrow's an ocean boat. And these little canals, I don't even have a depth sounder. And I had to anchor one night. And, you know, for the most part, it's 12 feet or deeper or so, somewhere around there. And I only draw 6 feet. But I go in, and I'm trying to get as far up in this little thing because the weather wasn't great. And I anchor, but I had no idea how much chain I needed to put out because it was all mucky water. And I was kind of like, oh. And I had to go tie a weight on a line and do depth measurements by, you know, going around the boat. And I found at the bow I was in like 8 feet of water. At the stern I was at 12 or something like that. But, you know, I think that's to the fact that the old methods do work.
Yeah.
And they're proven, and they don't rely on any – they don't rely on these complicated systems that have – although – they're way better now at not failing, but still.
It's missing the point, and I think you brought that out so well in your talk last night where you know, this visceral connection to nature, visceral connection to your boat, you know, those things are all taken away with every single device that you use.
Uh-huh.
You're getting further and further and further away from that connectivity, which is almost a spiritual experience.
It's a huge part of the draw for me to be out there and... There's something, like I said, you know, when we were talking, I think, this morning to a couple about some of the navigation equipment, and I was relaying how good it feels to take a sight with your sextant, even though I've got, you know, a bunch of different GPS things spitting right out at me, but take that, and then you find that position, compare it to your GPS thing, you're within like a half a mile, there is a huge sense of... Yeah. I don't want to say accomplishment. That's not the right word, but I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it. It just feels really good to know that I don't need to rely on those. I've got this one tool, and I need that sun up there, and I can do it.
So in kind of thinking through this, I have that. When I'm flying at 43,000 feet, I'm still looking for visual identification.
Yeah, right?
I'm still relying on my old school approach. But I'm just like the young pilot today that doesn't have to rely on that. I skip over that in boating, and I go right to my instruments.
Right to the instruments, and,
so that whole experience that you're talking about, I got no visceral connection to it. I'm just realizing that for the first time.
Well, you know, the nice part is, though, on a boat, you can turn all that stuff off, and you're not going to sink. I can only imagine. I mean, if for whatever reason there's catastrophic electronic failure on your airplane,
right?
But the engines, they would keep going, or no? Would they turn off?
They would keep going. And actually, I experienced that last year leaving Israel.
Oh, geez.
Kim and I were on our way out of Haifa, Israel, and we're heading to Cyprus, and our destination was Dubrovnik. And it was a long flight, and we needed every ounce of fuel, and we're climbing out of Israel. And just to get into Israel is a big deal.
I'm sure.
There's so many other levels, additional levels of security you have to go through. And we're leaving Israeli airspace, and Tel Aviv tells us, you're cleared to Cyprus, contact them on this frequency. And at the moment they say that, our entire panel went black.
Oh,
black.
Yeah.
And we have triple redundancy.
I mean,
this is computers running computers running computers. And it goes black, and I look at Kim, and Kim looks at me like, nobody briefs you on this.
Yeah.
Nobody briefs you on having a complete blackout. and then it came back on, and we looked at it, and it showed on the GPS that our airplane was in the middle of Africa.
Really?
Africa. We're not in, I mean, we're relatively close, but we're not in Africa.
Not even, you know, it takes a while to get down there. So it's a big continent.
We call them back, and they say, that is a problem. But you can't come back to Israel because you have to go through all these clearances.
And then
this other
senior
guy gets on the radio and says, wait a minute, let me contact Delta. And they called Delta and asked him if they had any problems with their equipment. And the guy casually said, oh, yeah, it went out again. And then it came back on about 10 minutes later. He'll be fine.
Some sort of radar jamming thing.
It was a jamming thing.
Yeah.
The Russians were jamming all the activity going on in Syria.
Ah, yeah. Okay. So that makes sense, right?
They just told us keep going. and you'll be fine.
A little unnerving, maybe?
Oh, totally.
Jeez. Well, I can't even imagine. I've never, well, okay, the scariest thing I've ever had happen in an airplane, and I don't know what type it was. I want to say it was a prop plane, but we were in Kenya doing a safari, and you had to fly from camp to camp.
Yeah, that was likely a prop.
One of the issues we had on there was, I'm assuming now knowing that it was all line of sight because we weren't going super high, but we got close to one place, but the cloud and fog bank or whatever was so thick that they could no longer see where they were trying to go. Yeah. And so I remember they kind of circled around and everybody was like a little bit worried. And then there was some sort of little hole or something that the pilot saw in the cloud straight down. And we banked and did like a corkscrew straight down as fast as we could. And oh, I've never experienced that feeling. The G-forces alone were crazy. And then popped us out underneath the cloud, and then we were good. But I mean, a bunch of us thought we were going down.
Yeah, I may or may not have done that myself.
Really?
Oh, <God. laughs> They call them sucker holes.
Sucker holes.
Yeah. And it's for suckers to go down there and see if they come out underneath this bank, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes the cloud banks go all the way to the ground.
Yeah, and
you
don't
come out.
Oh, my God.
You just keep drilling down, 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 down. And then when you pull out, it's, awkward.
Right. Yeah, a little bit. Well, luckily, I mean, we came out of it. And then, you get down there and it's all just grass, runways that have been mowed or whatever. The trick down there, though, is that you have to do a couple flybys to get all the zebras or the gazelles off the runway. And that's always pretty exciting because you go in pretty low and, look at the giraffes. And then, boom.
Yeah, and that's why those pilots love to fly there.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a risk in a lot of parts of Africa doing that.
Yeah.
But boy, what a beautiful scene. All the spots.
That must have been amazing.
Oh, that's a once in a lifetime trip. Obviously I've done a lot of stuff on sailboat and everything like that, but there's two trips in my life that I don't think I'll ever be able to top as far as just how wonderful they were. And that one, going to Kenya on like a two and a half week safari, multiple camps, life-changing just to see that. The other is rafting the Grand Canyon, the whole thing. I did a two-weeker when I was, I had to be 24 or something like that with a big group of old family friends and such, but on the small rafts. So, one guide oaring and, two in the front, two in the back. We were really fortunate because there were monsoon rains that year right before we got in. And so normally the Grand Canyon runs at about, 7 to 10,000 feet per second as far as how much water volume. We were running at 45,000. And some of these guys, they were like, this is unreal. A lot of the rapids disappeared. But a lot of the rapids had 10, 15-foot standing waves in them. And
oh, my gosh.
Just really lucky to be able to experience that. But sitting in those rafts, regardless of the action of the rapids, watching the Grand Canyon slowly peel by you while you just take it in, if you ever get a chance to do it, it's life-changing. It's the only way to see that big canyon is from that water level.
My son has talked about doing that, so maybe we'll figure that out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they do it with those guided ones. It's essentially, usually it's a group of maybe 20 people and you'd have 6-7 guides, but they're really, it's nice, you're camping, whatever, but they cook all the food and everything. But you can do either the first half, which is 7 days, or the second half. Or you can do the whole thing and it takes 14 and it's amazing. Oh. That's my plug on that one. Well, and to go back, because this is the funny thing. These things fly by. We're already at 45 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, I know, right? It's crazy. But for the trip around the world, what was the impetus of that? Where were you like, I think that'd be a good idea?
So my dad was a pilot in World War II. He flew B-26s and B-25s. He was an instructor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's where the whole love of flying started. But also, I think something that had influenced me early on is that he decided when he was 19 years old that he would go to Europe. And this is 1934.
Jeez.
And he and his buddy went to Europe, and they did the whole, you know, kind of, you know, fantasy trip where they're backpacking and getting on trains and not knowing where they're going and trying to figure out how to pay for stuff.
Yeah.
And he wrote a diary, and I read his diary, and I thought, that is just fascinating that he had the wherewithal to do that in the 30s, you know, in between, you know, university and
youngsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're young, man, that hasn't changed.
He talks about Germany and how they were holding the one hand up and how everybody seemed to be dressing the same. And he had no clue what was going on in the world. And I think that's kind of where the love of adventure and travel came from. And I thought I've got this other airplane. It's a 1943 flying boat. It's Grumman Widgeon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, for those that remember it, it was the same airplane they used in Fantasy Island, the series. Where DuPlane.
Yeah.
So I've had DuPlane for about 20 years, and I thought I wanted to do it in that, you know, because it was an old classic World War II airplane, and it could land on the water, or it could land on land. And anyway, I thought that was going to be my thing, and I was going to take a couple of years to do it. But I always kind of wanted to do that, just, I think, from the travel, you know, images that I got from reading my dad's journal.
Yeah.
And I love to travel, and I think that's where it started. Yeah, it started with reading my dad's journal when he was doing it at 19 in 1934.
Yeah, the inspiration right there.
Yeah.
So holy smokes.
That was the plan. And I wasn't planning on going with anyone. I was just going to do it in my little, you know, 75-year-old airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Honda Jet came up, and I thought, well, that would be nice.
That'd be a little more comfortable, probably a little speedier, yeah. I would think, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we called it Around the World in 80 Stays.
Yeah, I like that.
And Stays, STAYS, because we're in the hotel business, and it's 80.
Yeah.
And we just recorded it, and we, you know, my wife and I have always been completely enthralled with different cultures, and we thought it would be an amazing experience to experience that many cultures in one bite, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because typically when you go overseas, you're going to one place, and then the next year you'll go maybe to another place.
Yeah.
The next year, another place. But to go to 50 countries in 2.5 months and looking for the similarities,
yeah,
was something that we were super engaged with, and because we have a philosophy that we're all part of the same family, and people generally want the same things, and that's exactly what we found, you know, from you know, Fez, Morocco to Bali to Taiwan to Sapporo, Japan. I mean, all the way across the world, we found people that we connected with at a very, very personal level, simply because we tried to understand their culture.
And, yeah.
And then the other piece was, you know, we're in the hotel business, so we were looking at how different people, different countries, different hotels executed their form of hospitality and what really worked and what really didn't. And so the culture at Industry Hotels, that's my plug.
Nice shout out to that. I'll put a link in the description.
.com. You know, we pride ourselves in creating a culture of care, and it's unique because it's very personal, and it separates the whole idea of being a professional versus being an individual with real feelings and real personal issues that you deal with every day.
Yeah.
And so we invited that into the workplace when we started our company, and so we wanted to see how that translated in different countries. And and we found, you know, a lot of great hotels. We stayed in really nice hotels around the world, and some did it really well, and some did it really poorly. And ultimately, it was a confirmation that we were on the right track.
Right, right.
To personalize the hospitality experiences is the winning formula.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think a great example here in the BVI is, you've been down to Joost Van Dyke, right?
Yeah, we were there a couple days ago.
Yeah, Foxy's.
Yeah.
Foxy's is still, I believe, one of the 10 top 10 places to be at New Year's Eve on the planet. And part of the reason that, that allure and that legend is there is because of Foxy. And Foxy being Foxy, it wasn't that, you know, he had the cleanest glasses for your beer or he had the, you know, the nicest setup or anything like that. I mean, he definitely didn't. But he was genuine and he would engage with people and he built this legend that, I mean, that place could be around for another 100 years. Well past when I don't know if is he still alive? Was he there?
I don't even know. We're there in the middle of the day.
Oh, okay. I gotta Google it, I guess. But I've met him before and he, you know, he's a great guy. And that is, I think, what you're talking about, where he's bringing his personality,
right,
and his life and everything, and he's sharing it with the people that come in every single day, and that makes for that unique experience or that culture. And
yeah, and it's genuine, it's authentic.
Yeah,
it's real, and people can tell the difference. You know, when you're faking hospitality.
Oh yeah, it's the old plastic smile.
The plastic smiles and the you know the jargon that's used. Trained by some MBA somewhere that says this is how you express hospitality.
This is the most neutral compliment you can give.
Right. But people want to hear stories. They want to experience things. And, you know, the bed can be, you know, not the greatest. The decor may not be the best. But if you can create an authentic experience, then people will continue to come back and your staff is going to enjoy being at work and coming to work, and they're going to give a lot more of themselves to make sure that happens.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
They understand that that's the culture that they're working in, and they support it. So it's worked out well for us in our company.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there is obviously there's something to be said about the standards of a hotel or a resort. But when it really comes down to it, what separates one from another is the people and the personalities and the experience that guest has. Because if you can make, I think I've always thought, if you can make a guest feel like part of the team, part of the family,
right,
then all of a sudden it's not just a hotel, it's a home base.
There you go.
And they're going to come back and they're going to utilize that. You know, they might go on vacation in another spot during the year, but that's in addition to coming here for their annual visit.
That's right.
And that was something that was ingrained for sure here, but also at this family camp that I worked at in Michigan. I mean, people have been coming there for 40 years every single summer, never met generations of kids, you know, going there.
It's not a 5-star experience.
Oh, there were like for many decades, it was shower houses, you know, and things like that. And now it's, you know, everybody's got their own cabin, you know, it's going with the times, but still, it always sort of relied on that essential aspect of the staff and what they brought to the table and the experience of, you know, you're part of it. You're not just a guest who we are going to service. You are part of this experience. Like, I'm here working, you're here playing. Let's just try and have a good day.
So this is, you know, again, kind of looking at our two round the world experiences, extraordinarily different. Ends of the spectrum.
Yeah,
yours is individual self, you know, realize, you know, self actualization, you know, insight into nature and connectivity to your boat and yourself, and a very individual experience. Ours, we were purposely reaching out to other cultures, trying to engage in those cultures and having that experience define our trip. So it's really interesting to, you know, you can do this in many different ways, and there's no right or wrong.
No, oh, definitely. Yeah, and, you know, the beauty is that, who knows, maybe in 5 years, if I'm able to do my next big adventure, which would transition from a solo to, you know, 4 or 5 friends on the boat, and we go around through the trades for 5 years visiting all these places, you can do a speed record in your Honda Jet around the earth.
Right.
Because that begs the question, you know, what took you so long? 80 days?
Right.
I'm just kidding.
Right. What took you so long?
Pound for pound, man.
I could have done it. You know, the whole trip was 49 hours in the air.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you look at, you know, if you looked at the numbers of, you know, it's 29,000 miles, I think.
And it's sorry. Okay. Just to get it wrapped around in my head. You left from where?
Pensacola, Florida.
Pensacola, Florida, and you went west to east.
Yeah. So up to Maine, and then Greenland, Iceland, then uh-huh. over to Ireland, and then down to Portugal and Spain, then into Morocco, and back up to Italy, and then over to Turkey, and down to Israel, and then over to Dubai, and then over to India, and then up to Paro, Bhutan, yep. and then down to Cambodia, to Thailand, Vietnam. I wanted to go to Vietnam from my own personal experience as a youth, and and being part of the whole draft and Vietnam era.
Oh, right, right.
And then down from there, down to Bali, and then up to Taiwan, Japan, Russia, and then over to Alaska, and then British Columbia, and then back home.
Holy cow. And that took in the air
49 hours. Think about that versus what?
271 days. That's mind-boggling.
It is. I mean, for me, to think about 270 is mind-boggling. I was thinking...
Yeah, right.
Actually, I until you gave your talk, I didn't honestly understand that you are not going to stop.
Yeah, right. That I know.
Changed everything in my mind. It's like, holy smokes. I thought I was kind of out there. You're freaking amazing. I can't believe that you did what you did, when you did it, and how you did it, and... the planning, and it just blows my mind.
It was the dream that it took 5 years to plan and save the money, do all the stuff to be able to carry it out. But yeah, you know, there were a lot of times in between the thought of wanting to do it or me saying, okay, I am going to do it. Let's just get started. 5 years go by and I'm going to actually now commit to it and go for it. There were a lot of times where I was like, this is stupid. I don't know what the heck. This is not going to work. But there weren't a lot of times where I was like, I am afraid to go. That didn't start until I actually got out. The anxiety of like, uh-oh, so, I'm headed to the Southern Ocean.
So that lack of fear, I always, you know, people say I do things that are risky. I don't see them as risky. And I always attribute it to being highly ADD, that I don't understand the consequences of my actions far enough out to understand that I just may be doing something risky.
Right, right.
But something you did that was really insightful for me is that this idea of taking the whole trip and taking it in small bites.
Yeah.
And breaking it down to an hour from now or a day from now or a distance from now in these smaller increments. And building those up, it's like a marathon runner. I've heard the same thing.
Yeah.
That a marathon runner doesn't think about the entire marathon. He thinks about, or she thinks about, you know, the next 30 seconds or the next 1 minute. And once I get that minute behind me, then I got the next minute. That kind of thinking, I think, is it's miraculous. It's a great insight to how to tackle very difficult, very large projects.
Well, and it you know, the severity of sort of the anxiety that some new challenge, because, you know, out of the sea, everything can be going fine, and then something pops up, and you got to just deal with it, like, you know, a bad forecast for the coming week. And now all of a sudden you got that anxiety. And so then you'd shrink that, narrow that focus down even further to be able to just make it through that and make it through that. And, you know, it just like anything, though, it's not something you can just do. You have to practice it. Your brain is just like any muscle, I think. And if you practice things, the other one that I learned, and I think I mentioned it, but on the Appalachian Trail, was sort of replacing the thoughts that are going in your brain. So when you start thinking about bears, you have to physically, like, force some, or not physically, but mentally force another image, some happy place into your head. And then that bear comes creeping back in, and then you replace it again. I call it like my replacement theory. And if you do it enough, just like anything, you're going to get good at it to the point where you can push those thoughts out of your head and then move forward and get past. Because it's all about trying to lessen the anxiety and keep your brain and everything calm,
right,
so that you can make the right decisions and focus and redirect it. Because a patient or a calm brain can be refocused. One that's in panic mode and full of anxiety is just scattered, and it's not going to be useful in the little bit of time that you might have to prep for whatever is about to come at you. If you've got that calm brain, you can actually prepare. But if you don't, you're just going to sit there and freak out and not be in any different place than when you are now to when that thing comes. And
so what do you attribute your ability to do that? Because not everybody has that capacity. What do you?
Well, I think everybody does for the most part. What I had that most people don't is I had a lot of time of just me on that boat dealing with these things over and over again. The anxiety of like, oh my gosh, I got another 8 months to go, or oh no, here comes another name storm, or you know, that looks like a bad weather. And it would, you know, it could be something like a cyclone that's a week away that I have to worry about for that whole time. Or it could just be these little micro doses of it where, you know, it's nighttime and I get up to just do a quick little look around and now there's a big squall cloud. And I'm like, ah, oh geez, how bad is this one gonna be? So I think between the time of me being alone and being able to sort of toy with your brain, but also having to constantly deal with another challenge. And like, you know, once you practice it enough, you really start to get good with it.
So at what point did your water maker fail?
Oh man, that was a nightmare.
Because that to me is a no-go. I mean, you stop at that point.
And to be fair, one of the nice parts about being an offshore sailor is that you can't really just stop. You have to typically sail for a week or more just to get back to the nearest point of land. And that prevents, I think, me from being able to pull or press the I quit button.
Yeah.
Because I can't really technically do that.
Right.
I still have to get back. And in the time it would take me to sail, maybe in that point I was like 600 miles away from Madagascar. I think that was the closest point of land. And I would have had to sail back up there closer to the Cape of Good Hope, which is really scary anyway. I wanted to be away from that. And I figured, you know, if I would have turned back, I'm sure I would have, I don't know, I probably would have caught some rain or something and been like, oh, I think this is manageable, and then kind of head off. But that was really scary, because at first I thought, oh, okay, I'll be able to fix this. And I glued it all and used this epoxy that I figured, you know, would be perfectly strong. And you have to wait. The hardest part was you have to wait 24 hours for it to fully cure.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and it's the only thing that's on my mind. I'm just like, oh, I wonder if it's going to work. I wonder if it's going to work. Because I just didn't have much water at that point. I'd let it get way past where I should have. My safety level should have been around 50 gallons, and then I start pumping.
Yeah.
I let it get down to like 15 gallons.
Oh, my God.
So stupid. But, you know, I was only 38 at the time. So nowhere near, you know, the wisdom I've gained in all these years. Well, Julian, I even hate to wrap this up, but I got to go get ready and I got to troubleshoot those bugs out of that computer so I don't get any skipping footage for tonight. All but right. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Me too. Thanks for inviting me and thanks for showing some interest in a whole different round the world experience.
Oh, heck yeah. No, and good luck. I mean, that's going to be interesting. We'll have to definitely stay connected, because the plan is at the end of next month to go across the Atlantic in this vessel, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So start off in St. Martin, up to Bermuda, over to the Azores, and then Gibraltar. So something I've never done before, and I'm really enjoying the process of trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, and have you been to Bermuda?
Never, no.
Or the Azores?
No.
Oh my gosh, you're gonna, like, if you like cultures, Bermuda is so unique. It's so, I don't want to spoil anything for you, but it's brilliant. It really is something special. And then the Azores are like a whole nother, you want to be able to, and they've got a lot of islands there, lots of like hot boiling pools and springs and a really, really great culture. Cause it's, I believe it was Portugal. They're independent now, maybe still a little dependent on them, but it's an amazing, yeah. You'll see when you go. It's really cool. You're going to have a lot of fun. It's really just going to be the weather in between them. But I think with this vessel, having a good look at her, your chances are pretty darn good.
Thanks. I need a vote of confidence.
Exactly. All right, Julian, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.